zijn Ingrid en Gara, founders of NoCo.
This is a series of podcasts, Business of Collaboration, a conversation with a professor and a business executive.
Once per month, we interview a professor and a business on how to work together to find a common understanding and inspiration.
So subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and on our website noco.net. Join us in our journey.
Today we are at the office of Samske Group in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands, for our Business of Collaboration podcast. Samskip is a global logistic company offering transport and related services by land, sea, rail and air.
We are interviewing Ragnar Ragnarsson, CIO of Samskip Group, and Professor Finn Wijnstra, who is specialized in purchasing and supply management at Erasmus University.
Ragnar is born in Iceland, but living and working in Rotterdam for almost 20 years. He loves to play golf and enjoys reading in the early mornings during the weekend and enjoys family life.
And Finn is Dutch and researches innovation through collaborations with suppliers and how startups become vendors after their collaborations. He enjoys carpentry work in the weekends and also enjoys family life.
We will talk about the value of blockchain within logistics, the importance of doing innovation together with suppliers, and how to develop long-term relationships with partners.
And if you want to learn more about Ragnar and Finn after this podcast, you can of course read the interviews with them at noco.net.
Welcome. Today we are in Rotterdam in Samskip office in the port of Rotterdam with Ragnar, CIO of Samskip, and Professor Finn Wijnstra from Erasmus University in Rotterdam. So welcome here and thank you very much for doing the podcast with us.
You're welcome.
And of course, we have a first question for you, for both of you. But let's start with Ragnar. How did you start working for Samskip?
Yeah, well, I first started working for Samskip back in 1993. It was my first job after graduation from the university. I worked there for a few years and then did some other work, still in the logistics industry, bit of software. And then joined Samskip back in 2004 as the group CIO. And yeah, still here.
Beautiful company to work for.
Thank you.
Amazing. And Finn, can I ask you, how did you become a professor? Or is it...
Yeah, well, I've been in academia since 93, roughly. So I did my PhD both in Eindhoven University of Technology and in Sweden, in Uppsala. And then actually I got an invite to come and apply in Rotterdam because they wanted to establish the area of procurement. And that was kind of tempting. So and I was still living around Rotterdam. I had studied in Rotterdam as well. So a lot of things came together. Yeah.
So you started in 1995?
As a PhD student. I finished my... my economics degree, and then
and looking at, because you're both very innovative people, you're from the academic side, you're from the business side. If you look at innovation, what is innovation for you? How would you define it?
Yeah, to me, I mean, innovation is something. I mean, in our business, is really, really part of our almost our day-to-day work. You have to be continuously improving and finding new ways to. You can say automate things, do things more efficiently, work closely with our suppliers and customers to keep them informed about the services that we provide. When it comes to technology, I mean, since I started working for Samskip, it has been you can say a constant journey of innovations. Like I described here earlier, I mean, when I started, fax and telegraphs were the main communication method in our business. So we've come a long way since then.
And if you're looking at it, because do you see it moving faster and faster, or do you see a common pace?
Definitely. Faster? I see it moving a lot faster now. I mean, it happened gradually, you can say, in the 90s, early 20s. I see it happening a lot faster now, and you see new technology being introduced, actually operationalized a lot faster than I've seen before.
Yeah, because you mentioned in 1993 you were working with fax and with the telegrams.
Yeah.
And now, 25 years later, you are doing a project with blockchain.
Yeah.
So in 25 years, it's huge, the jump in technology.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, if you look at when did you first hear about blockchain? And, you know, it's only maybe a couple of years.
Yeah.
But now you see it in almost any initiative when it comes to the logistics and supply chain industry. Mm-hmm. People are trying to make use of blockchain in their innovative solutions. We still have to see how it works out, but it's promising.
Yeah, it's just starting. Huh? And looking at innovation, what does it mean for you? What is innovation to you?
Well, it's both an object of study. So we look my team and in our wider department, we'll study innovation processes within, but particularly also between organizations. So my original PhD thesis was very much about how companies increasingly outsourced research and development tasks to suppliers, say in automotive or electronics industry. So that's a field of study, but obviously we as a university internally also have to be innovative. There's a lot of competition now with massive online open courses, all kinds of other knowledge providers, training providers. So we need to also adapt our delivery methods, if you like, but also creation methods of our research. Where do we get our data for our research? So there's constantly new developments going on as well. My colleagues are using Twitter sentiment data to predict stock market developments, etc. So there's both in research and teaching, innovation is not only, let's say, the thing we study, but also the process in our own work.
Yeah, you were talking that before we started the podcast about doing a podcast for RSM.
Yeah.
So it could be one of the master classes. You can record a podcast and then you have deliver instead of videos, maybe the classes are a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. We do a lot in teaching, so we have a lot of my colleagues that we have increasingly e-lectures, not just because we have big groups and students don't come to class, but also to enable students to later on, when they really need the information or knowledge, to kind of on-demand go to lectures. We also do in testing. So, for instance, I use brief quizzes electronically at the start of class and to keep the students on their toes, and they also like the format, and they like to have the mobile phone and so on, just for the exam, right? Just for the quiz, then they have to put it away. But I also noticed that we need to do it for a reason. Sometimes just being innovative for the sake of it doesn't help. Some time ago we also asked students in the course to maintain their own blog about topics related to the course, and that's something they did not like, because then we kind of, it felt as if we are intervening in their personal space in a way, their Facebook accounts and so on. So that's not something they wanted. Yeah,
not yet anyway.
No, exactly.
I also agree with you when you say, you know, a lot of the innovation work is being outsourced to suppliers. I mean, of course, in our industry, we see this a lot in the, you know, development of autonomous trucks, vessels, inland barges, and you see these, you know, large suppliers who have actually the capital to do this kind of innovation. Whereas a transport company like Samskip, we would actually never have the capital or means to take on that kind of innovation. Yeah. But we obviously follow it very closely, and, you know, like with our truck vendors, we take part in some testing and so on.
We collaborate with other suppliers often. Okay, that brings me to the next question, by the way, because you obviously work closely with suppliers on developing new technology. And Professor, you're researching in partnerships with vendors and internally on what innovation can provide for value to business. Looking at the collaboration, because obviously a lot of collaboration needs to be there to innovate for a purpose and with value, does a good collaboration look like for you?
A good collaboration has to happen when everyone involved has something to bring to the table and are willing to, you know, share the knowledge and put some efforts into it. Yeah. And then often, you know, when people work together like that from different angles, then, yeah, something good comes out of it.
Yeah, so it is at the end the result, but also the way to get there.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's both ways.
You can collaborate for many different reasons. And indeed, I think, if, particularly if you look at collaborations within the supply chain, and there has to be something in it for everyone to make it durable, I think, and to make it effective. For the one company, it could be a new product, but maybe for the other company, it could be a better relationship with that other partner. That it's usually not objectives which are in conflict with each other. I do think that in quite some organizations, there is a big focus on the short run. It depends per country, it depends on ownership structure, but that is, I think, one of the challenges we have now with increased dynamics and technological development, company ownership, etc., that some of the more tricky and valuable collaboration needs a long-term perspective, and that's not always enhanced, I'll say, promoted by today's business and economic environment.
Yeah, because everything needs to be so fast in order to keep up with the competition, right, I guess?
Yeah.
How to keep a long-term relationship with the vendors? If, for instance, I don't know, some skill maybe they have 200 vendors or more?
A lot more.
A lot more, yeah. So how to keep this long-term relationship is very challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, good collaboration is one of the keys to keeping a good relationship running for both parties to want to continue. Also, when I look at our more on the customer side, and you mentioned a bit of a short-term view.
Yeah.
I mean, often when we onboard new clients, we want to, of course, integrate and be, you know, the key partner in transport. But when the customers look at it from their point of view, they might have 200 different carriers, and they don't necessarily want to put in any extra effort to do some extra integration with one carrier. So
yeah,
this is often the dilemma I see in the environment, and it's also hindering the, full efficiency that I could see happening.
I can imagine that. And of course, also the customer relationship is changing nowadays. They're more demanding, looking for different channels to
Absolutely.
Come to you.
And if
you look at the whole process, because, you know, you innovate with suppliers, with vendors, with all kinds of types of people to gain more value out of the process, to improve the process, where do you still see possibilities for improvement of the process to reduce operational costs, optimizing routes, delivery times reduction, for instance, or the e-commerce I just mentioned, the new way of the customers wanting to interact with you? Is there a lot of optimization still to be done, or is it moving even faster now with the whole digitalization, the capabilities we see there?
Yeah, I would say definitely. When Samskip is a pretty, you can say, traditional carrier. Of course, mm-hmm. It has evolved, it has mm-hmm. grown. We are constantly opening, developing our network. But obviously, when you see what's happening now with digitalization and new players like Amazon,
yeah,
like Alibaba, like with these new digital freight platforms, and you see players with capital coming into this industry, which I have never seen before,
mm-hmm.
and things happening a lot faster than and more dictated by these players. When I look at it more on from our side, I mean, there's a huge potential for more open information sharing and more transparency in the whole transport process. And I see it a lot more from our especially our larger customers, where they're demanding more. Demanding real-time information, GPS signals from the trucks that are delivering goods, and so on. So definitely a lot happening and a lot of potential still.
Yeah. So, and do you act on it?
Of course.
Of course. Do you feel fast enough?
No.
Or you want to move faster?
And also the challenge there, I mean, we are a multimodal operator. This means we are also very much dependent on our suppliers.
Of course.
And it's a challenge to get them also involved and participate in the programs that we are, you know, trying to deploy and you know, in order to serve our customers better. This is I'm not going to say a constant battle, but it's a challenge, and we are constantly working on it.
So what do you see as top challenges there? Next to the suppliers, you need to get them along, of course, but is it also the maybe budget or time or resources or technology maybe? I think
it's in a way, it's a lack of standardization in this industry. And there's ownership of data and who is really holding the information about the entire chain, and that is a big deal. Often the day-to-day issue. But that's also where I see blockchain as a possible solution, where there is distributed ownership of the data, where everyone who has been authorized to see it or contribute to, you know, giving information, they have access to it. But there is no one central body who controls it and owns it. So that's very much what I am looking to seeing blockchain coming into this industry.
So improved collaboration through blockchain.
How
do you see it, Phil?
Yeah, I think in the end, I see two challenges in terms of information sharing. I think one is the dimension, how far along the supply chain you're sharing information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think since the 1980s, we're talking about supply chain management. But if you really look into it, quite often it's window dressing, and people just manage their direct tier, the first tier suppliers or their direct customer. And I think technologies such as blockchain really enable sharing of information across the supply chain, where there is a lot of possible vulnerabilities or value improvements. Those technologies enable companies to share this information beyond their first tier level with some securities in place or safeguards in place at minimal cost. But I think before that, also companies want to know more about their supply chain. The tsunami in Japan a few years ago was a critical incident where a lot of companies started to realize that they knew who their first-tier suppliers were, but they actually didn't have a clue who their second-tier suppliers were. So they thought they were safe because their first-tier suppliers weren't in Japan. But then a few weeks later, the shit hit the fan, so to say, and then they got into trouble because the sub-suppliers were in Japan. And so I think before... And it's already a starting point to know who is in your supply chain. And for some products, that's more important than for others. But that is one thing. So the critical dimensions is how many actors along the chain do you exchange your information, and what level. I think there's a lot of information to be shared at the, let's say, the operational level. But what I often notice is that companies, and you were into the sometimes contrasting objectives of customers and suppliers, and quite often I notice that that also on the buyer side, which I deal with a lot, is that companies and persons are very reluctant to share more strategic information. And strategic information does not always need to be confidential information. So I think there is also a lot still to improve. Many buyers are unwilling to tell their supplier what they actually want from the supplier in terms of the value, because I think it harms their negotiation position. Well, I think that's not always the best approach.
Yeah, so looking at suppliers, I had a question about a strong relationship with suppliers. Can that actually help you to improve operations? But I guess it's not only the suppliers, but also the levels above those suppliers, the second level and other upper levels, to get them collaborating and to know them as well, have a relationship with them as well. Or don't you see a direct relationship with them necessary?
Yeah, I think in our case, I mean, obviously we are you can say, an asset operator in a way. And we are very dependent also on our suppliers. I would say our main focus is on our direct suppliers, so much what's behind that. But like I said, you know, this is one of our core activities to manage and deal with our suppliers. And if they fail, then our service fails. So very, very dependent on them.
And then I read some of your interview questions. You already answered. Thank you for that. That you're doing a project actually together with the Port of Rotterdam, Port of Tilbury, the custom authorities, and BlockLab, a startup, to really implement blockchain technology. I guess there's some use cases you defined to actually do that for the whole digitization and sharing of the information you just mentioned. How do you see, can this technology help in the communication with suppliers and your customers? You have some examples you can share.
Yeah, well, this project is an initiative of the Port of Rotterdam. Mm-hmm. And something they have decided to, you can say, strategically invest in. And we were invited as a carrier to participate. And when just looking at the project details, it was very interesting for us. We also see it as a certain preparation and part of the things we are doing to prepare for Brexit. How we can make sure that information sharing between the Netherlands and the UK side of things are as efficient as possible. Of course, Brexit is just around the corner, so I'm not sure this will actually be one of the main elements to secure information sharing there. But it's one of the projects that we are very excited about, and we are also going to involve a couple of clients of ours. Okay. And ask them to participate, to basically, the things, or let's say the transport starts with our customers, then they make a booking. And that's something we want to then work with in terms of sharing between all these different parties.
So it touches your customer in the first use case, yourself, of course, suppliers probably, and the Port of Rotterdam authorities. Yeah. It's kind of a...
Customs authorities on both sides of the channel. And it will be interesting to see.
Do you know the technical details of how to use the blockchain for this?
I think it will basically all be there. So as soon as a customer makes a booking, that's what triggers the carrier, who has to then do his planning and inform the customer about collection times, and then it basically follows the chain all the way to delivery. And obviously, when a delivery has been made, that triggers the customer to see his proof of delivery, and payments can also be made subsequently.
And data shared amongst the parties, so nobody owns the data, and everybody can access it.
Exactly.
How do you see blockchain thing?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I think Ragnar is much more informed about blockchain. I'm still trying to understand it. So it is not the theme that is directly related to my current research portfolio. We do see now the interest from different student groups, such as the MBAs, for instance. Mm-hmm. They recently asked, okay, can you please tell us a bit more about blockchain? I'm still trying to understand, is it the software, or is it an operating system? In the sense that, does blockchain really deal with the problem of different standards in terms of information protocols, etc.? So that is for me, and I think the answer to that varies perhaps also across industries. But for me, I'm very interested in your views, Ragnar. For me, it seems like a distributed operating system, and it doesn't automatically result in increased standardization of information exchange formats, if you like.
I mean, and you're absolutely right there, and this is still something we have to see how it develops. Standardization of the data that is being shared is that still has to be worked out.
Yeah.
But obviously, I also see this, this, we are doing one project, but this is happening all around us. I mean, Maersk has been doing a major project with IBM. I see several startups, promoting blockchain solutions within the logistics industry, within supply chain, within, carriers and so on. And I still have to see how this will all work together. Yeah. I mean, I've sometimes used the analogy of the mobile networks and mobile carriers. Somehow they manage to, standardize the whole protocol they are using. Yeah. And you can travel the world, yeah, and you can still use your phone, yeah, and you can still, see the charges on your bill.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, when it comes to blockchain and logistics, if we will see some, different networks of blockchain all collaborating together, so one user can just trust that he can have one interface,
yeah. Yeah.
And then everyone else can then participate.
Yeah,
it's still, like you said, $1 million question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
we'll see the use cases pop up, of course, and then if they start implementing the technology and successful model or not.
Absolutely.
I think that's. Yeah. How do you see this? Because you've been to Hamburg, right, with the RSM students with SOMSKIP, I think.
Yes, that was it was not a major part of the program, mm-hmm, but actually we had a colleague from the Hamburg office join during a boat trip, and he was taking questions on an individual basis from the students. I've not listened in on each conversation the students had, but obviously they're at that time of the program, they were interested in career opportunities. So the students there were a few guys actually that year that had worked on ships before. They had been a sailor on ships, so they came now to the same port. So they were obviously interested in talking to SOMSKIP about career opportunities and their own developments. I think the multimodal aspect was interesting, yeah, to some of the students, so not just shipping, but also connecting the different types of transport modes, and how does that affect the possible roles of employees in the end? What kind of skills does SOMSKIP look for? But indeed, how to manage different types of suppliers and how to know those different markets as well. So that's, I think, some of the topics that we're discussing, as we touched upon earlier.
See it in the multimodal transportation model. Do you see the use of blockchain there as well, specifically because you're in that model?
Yeah, I think, especially in the multimodal, this could be, you can almost say a game changer. I mean, you can compare a multimodal transport of a container from Italy to, let's say, UK. And you can imagine the number of different stakeholders that has to participate in that chain, from the collection by a truck to a rail depot in Italy, with a rail operator to a rail terminal in Duisburg, with a barge operator down to Rotterdam, port authorities, terminals, vessel over to the UK, same thing on that side, and then a truck to deliver, versus a truck backing up to a production facility in Italy, driving for a couple of days through the channel and delivering.
Yeah, and done. Yeah.
So you can imagine the different parties that have to be involved and have to be kept informed and instructed what to do with this box and this train and so on.
Yeah.
Well, quite an interesting use case.
Yeah. And in this, how this works today is basically SOMSKIP is in the middle.
Yeah.
And we have to keep everyone informed of all the different activities.
So you're handling now all the data and the sharing data. It across.
Yeah, yeah.
And with blockchain, you don't have to take care of that anymore, of course. It takes care of itself.
Yeah.
Well, that's the idea.
That is the idea.
Yeah. That would be a major improvement.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if I may ask also a question. You're operating in different ports, yeah? At least Hamburg, Rotterdam, in continental Europe.
Yeah.
How important for you is the role of a port authority in that respect in helping promote this kind of adoption of new technologies? You mentioned earlier this project here in Rotterdam. Is Port of Rotterdam different than Hamburg? Or That is that important also, that problem?
I think, I mean, in general, port authorities have been are very important in developing the environment with all the parties involved in operating in each port. But also when it comes to just managing the flow in and out of these ports, this is, of course, very important for the operators. I mean, this is the first time, actually, I get involved in a project where the port authorities are actually leading the initiative. And, I think we might even see more of this.
Again, I'm not an active port expert, but there's been talk in the press also that the port authority in the past was very much that if they started some kind of innovation, that all of the actors in the Rotterdam port area should be kind of involved in that. Mm-hmm. But that they're now, according to Albert Kastelein, the CEO, that they also, well, they want to run with the leaders, so to say. So if there's just one or two companies that are interested in developing new innovation, so that no longer the slowest actor kind of determines the pace. Very interesting to see.
The slowest mover determines the pace.
Well, that would, in the past, I think they would kind of that needed to be full support and kind of democratic Dutch consensus built model. the polder model. But now, and now they kind of at least said publicly that they wanted to kind of if there's one or two companies that really want to take the lead, we'll run with them and not wait for the the pack to stay in.
Well, that's a good change, I think. Mm-hmm. It's innovation moves faster that way.
That's the idea.
And I think you're all very, very busy with your current jobs, right? Like you said, you didn't even have time to have breakfast this morning. And we're here quite, it's not entirely dinner time yet, but we're heading towards it.
Yeah.
So looking at that, how do you balance work, life, family, and being on top positions like a professor and a CIO?
You first.
Yeah, that's always a challenge, I must say. I mean, I can think a while back when everyone was talking about basically splitting between work and your private life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was probably one of the people who very early started to basically, I like to say, working while living.
That's not a work-life balance, but it's a type of work-life balance.
Exactly. So, for example, just when mobile technology started to, be quite common and you have access to information, your emails, you know if something is going on that needs your attention and so on. But that also gives you comfort to, leave work early and do something different, and then you can just follow things. So so I actually like to keep it a little bit blended and still focus on my personal life and my hobbies and family and so on.
I guess that because it's kind of a flexibility you actually developed, that helps you with keeping the stress levels down as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I am a very calm person by nature.
Yeah, you look pretty relaxed.
So it definitely helps me. I would say it has helped me a lot in my personal life, how technology has developed to keep you to date in everything that's going on in both personal life and working life.
So it's a good thing of innovation and social media, I guess.
I definitely see it in a positive way. And but you also have to learn to switch off when you want to switch off.
Yes.
How
was your work life?
Well, it varies. So I think there's times that it's better than in other times. But university in general is a pretty flexible. We're in relatively independent professionals. I don't have to punch a clock, or in that way, there's a lot of flexibility. Since our first son was born, I've been working part-time, and that has helped a lot, I think, to kind of also have a day to say, well, it's my choice to attend the meeting or to take that phone call. And my wife has done the same. Officially together we work 1.5, but I think in the end it's 2.0 or something, but still, and we can say no. So that's good. I had to learn it the hard way. I had a burnout a couple of years ago, and I've been better at it since, I think. But it's not easy. Even in academia, you are flexible. But compared to, I think, organizations such as Samskip or other commercial organizations, I have relatively little admin or leadership possibility or responsibilities. It varies. I may take on a new position the 1st of January. That comes and goes in our business. But even if you only have your own research, your own team, it never is finished. There's always one more article to write or to read. So that's what you have to say. Okay, now it's time also to do other things. And sometimes have to learn the hard way.
How did you overcome the burnout?
I did a few things which I did. There was a lot of good advice from colleagues and from personal friends. Two of my close friends and colleagues advised to get a dog, but I didn't do that in the end. I would have liked to, but it was just not. I took some time off. I actually just stopped before, and I had 4 days appointment at that time. I went down to two. I kept my admin role, but I stopped my teaching for a while. I found some good replacements. My boss was very supportive of that. And then in about half a year's time, I went back to 4 days a week again. And I spent more time doing the things I like to do, carpentering, maintenance work, and doing real things with my hands, and being outdoors. That was one of the best ways.
Yeah, sometimes it needs an external thing like that to actually, make yourself more aware of the work life balance you're looking for.
Yeah,
it's good advice. It's thank you. We're coming to the end of the first part, and now we have some quick questions for you. To end with an easy tone, actually.
Yeah, something light.
And that's, yeah, of course. We all need that just before the holiday season. So, first question, where are you going on holiday? What's your favorite place?
In the middle of the summer, then nothing beats to go to Iceland. So I'm actually going there coming Thursday.
Okay, that's soon. Wow.
Yeah. So I will spend a week in the office first, and then... Then a couple of weeks off, traveling around. So I will visit some family in the north of Iceland, and I will visit my wife's family, which is really in the west.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you always have to a little bit look at the weather forecast as well, because it can vary a lot.
So what is it like now? Should be good weather like here as well.
Actually, been terrible this summer.
Oh no!
really?
Yeah, it's most of the time it's actually opposite to the Netherlands.
Oh, it is.
So we've enjoyed this fantastic spring and summer here.
Yeah.
And in Iceland, it's been completely opposite, especially on the south coast. Actually, when I speak to friends or family in Iceland, I just don't mention the weather anymore.
But
hopefully it will change now. So that's my plan for the summer.
Nice. Yeah, it's a nice trip.
Yeah.
Always good to visit family.
Yeah. My plans are, this year we're going to the Alps, to Austria and Switzerland, to do some hiking with the family. Usually our holidays involve mountains and water, so that's combination. And most of the times I like to go in the direction of Iceland or Norway or Greenland or places like that, so anything around the polar circle is good. But this year we're still in the mountains part, so that's good. Yeah.
And Austria is very beautiful for walking.
Absolutely.
And the Nordics, Iceland, of course, as well. Because are you doing activities when you go to Iceland?
Walking, this summer I always play golf.
Yeah.
So that's always somehow part of the agenda.
It's a perfect sport to play anyway.
Yeah. I mean, we when we go on holidays, especially in spring or autumn, we like to go, somewhere playing golf, but hiking is really not my thing.
Well, sometimes with golf, it's quite a hike.
It's quite, it's quite a walk, but I also do, I mean, I also do quite some hunting.
Okay.
In Iceland in the autumn, and then a bit in Europe as well, but that always involves quite some work.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Nice.
What do you hunt?
Yeah, well, in Iceland, you can, it's mainly birds.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But tamatian and geese, ducks, and also hunt reindeers in Iceland. But that's a bit of a lottery every year if you
get a permit.
If you get a permit. Yeah, in Poland, it's different types. It's roe deer and wet deer.
Fly fishing?
Fly fishing a bit, yeah. You know, Icelandic salmon rivers are, I think, one of the best in the world for fly fishing.
What is fly fishing?
Fly fishing is like, yeah, you have a rod where you basically, and you have a small fly. It's a little bit different than fishing with bait. So that's when you put something on the hook and try to catch the fish like that. But fly fishing is a bit different sport.
Yeah.
It's very active.
Yeah.
Have you read this book, The A River Runs Through It? It's a very nice book about...
It's fly fishing, right?
Yeah. It's about Montana, Wyoming. And it's, there's a movie after
exactly,
it.
Exactly, that's where I know the name.
And fly fishing is a big part there. Yeah.
Awesome, nice holidays, are you?
Yeah.
So, and your evenings, because in the morning you don't take breakfast.
That was a one-time
eat. That was a one-time eat. How does your evenings look like?
Oh, it's very...
relaxing, or sporting, or...
Since recently, well, it might involve working, so sometimes we have evening classes, so teaching sometimes. Yeah. I recently started going to the gym with my neighbor, so that's now, it should be once a week, so that might, and I may have a meeting with some local board that I'm involved with, so, but mostly I'm at home, fortunately.
And you have off?
Yeah, of course it varies, but you know, I definitely like to take time in the evenings to basically meet with the kids and talk about the day, and of course the wife.
Yeah.
Don't forget that.
Wife says thank you.
Yeah. I also see a big difference if I look back when you know, TV was often a very big part of the evenings, which is almost just disappeared today.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, they had this, you can say, linear TV programs, the news were at a certain time of the evening and you wanted to see the news and so on, but that's just history and somehow it just faded away.
So no more TV anymore, or
it's a little bit, but it's more for live sports, you know, TV shows on Netflix and so on. So I basically don't watch linear TV anymore. But I also like to go out. I like to go out and play nine holes for 2 hours and, you know, it clears your head. Here in Rotterdam, I really like to take my youngest son out for a round of golf and get him also a bit active after the day. It varies.
You can play with the whole family.
Yeah.
So during your spare time, I guess I know about the golf and the fishing, the hunting. Is there anything more you'd like to do within your spare time?
So the if I had not gone into economics and management, I would have liked to become an architect. So, now I try to compensate by renovating furniture or renovating old caravans and these kind of things. So, doing small handiwork projects. Yeah. So that is one thing. And then, my children are a bit younger, I guess. So they're 11 and 15. So I still take the boys to sports together with my wife. My wife is more into soccer than I am, but still I get to go to the soccer games as well.
So you're not a coach yet.
I've been a coach and a trainer, but for 2 years or something. Mm-hmm. So now there's more qualified fathers who do that.
Sounds you both have a great life next to working. So and a great work-life balance nowadays.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I think we finished. We'd like to thank you for this very nice conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We wish you a very nice summer holiday.
And you, thank you. Yeah. What are your plans?
Oh, I know what to make. Thank you for listening to the podcast. As usual, you can find a sum up of this podcast with pictures and interviews at noco.net. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our account is NoCo Platform. See you next month.